There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Mandel, and I'm your host. And today, it's the first time we're on a new station, WNUR, Evanston, Illinois. Also hitting the north side of Chicago here, the great Northwestern University. So I want to say hello to everyone there listening in here in the Chicago area. And yes, my name is Paul Rees-Mandel. I am your host. And today I'm bringing on a guest, my good friend, John Anderson. John's a radio veteran. He's a radio pro. He is a refugee of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, a former morning anchor for the Wisconsin Radio Network, who is now turncoat.
I'm also very proud to be, I think, the longest running guest on Media Geek ever.
Oh, absolutely.
I think I do hold that distinction now because you used to do a show called Radio Free Conscience,
mm-hmm.
and then you decided to change the format of that show to be more media specific in the way you wanted to look at things. And that was like, what, 2000?
2002.
2002. And I met you in 2000,
mm-hmm.
and through our mutual affinity for things like pirate radio. And we've been doing, I've been your John Nichols,
to my Bob McChesney, yeah,
for eight years now.
Mm-hmm. No, it's been a fantastic partnership because, yeah. We share a mutual affection for radio and the power and potential of radio, a medium which many say is dying or is dead because the clear channelization of it. But there are all these great, little strong plants, a little piece of grass, sticking up through the sidewalk, frequently on the left end of the dial in cities and towns all over the country, whether it's community stations like WEFT or WRFU there in Urbana, Illinois, or great stations like the one we're on here, WNUR in Evanston. And there's other great stations in the Chicago area, too, like down at the University of Chicago, that try very hard to not just be like all the other stations in the dial, but to share that resource. And WNUR does that. I'm a community volunteer. I'm actually the advisor of the station now, if you can imagine that happening.
You're a big man. Yeah.
But there are lots of other community volunteers on the station who mingle with the students. But the great thing about it, and why I'm really, really excited to be here, is that this is a student-run station. The students run this broadcast operation. The general manager is a student, program director is a student, the executive board is a student. I'm an advisor, but I mean, I'm really an advisor. I'm there to help out, make sure, of course, that FCC obligations are fulfilled, and to give advice whenever necessary, and make sure that the obligations to the university are fulfilled. But besides that, students made these decisions about what goes on the air. And John, I want to talk, just a little bit set up, to put a little bit of a bio on you. And some of the regular Media Geek listeners, people who've listened on the podcast or listening at our stations, might know something about you. We try to introduce you, but not everyone pays as much attention. But so I mentioned that you are a refugee of the Telecom Act of 1996, where you were the morning anchor for Wisconsin Radio Network. Until right. When did you leave?
2000. I started my commercial radio career actually in 1993. I originally went to college to be a meteorologist because I liked severe weather and wanted to chase tornadoes in Oklahoma, but calculus pretty much is beyond my comprehension. So I found myself at the student radio station, fell in love with radio, and then decided over the course of having to switch majors that maybe I should look into radio as a career. And so I went to the local mom-and-pop AM-FM-owned combo radio station in Valparaiso and said, I'll clean your toilets if I can at least get some radio experience. And the guy's like, sure, why don't you sit and, monitor the automation on Friday nights from midnight to 6, Friday night, Saturday morning. So there went my party time. And I got involved in commercial radio that way, basically by babysitting machines. And then a news job opened up, and I'm like, well, I can write, and I like to tell stories, so why don't I do that? And so I started doing that as well. Probably the biggest story I covered was in 1994 when a plane crash happened just in Northwest Indiana. It was a little commuter plane, but all 68 people on board were killed, and I was the first one on the scene, and that was like my first introduction into big time journalism, you know, and what it was and it was exciting, and it was also very lucrative. Stringing for a national news network is a very good way for a college student to pay off their apartment rent for a month. And so I thought, this is the thing for me. Radio news is the thing for me. And so I kept working, and I was going to school, and I was also managing this radio station on the student radio station at the same time. So I was totally immersed in the whole idea of radio and the various aspects of it, and graduated in 1996, and that's the same year that Congress passed the Telecommunications Act. And of one of the many things, it was a complete rewrite of U.S. communications law, the first of its kind since 1934. Well, one of the major things that it did was it allowed massive consolidation within the radio industry. It removed the national cap on the number of stations any one company could own, leading to the rise of companies like Clear Channel and things like that. And I moved during this process. From 1996 to 2000, I moved. I went from Indiana to Madison, Wisconsin. I was married at the time. My wife was going to grad school there. I got a job on a Madison radio station, worked there for about a year, and then got a job with, as you said, this Wisconsin radio network. It's a statewide news network carried on, the point I was there was like 54 stations in the state of Wisconsin, the largest being the biggest stick in the state, WTMJ in Milwaukee, and the smallest being some station run out of some guy's house just outside of Wisconsin Dells. So we had this wide variety of radio stations that we served, and also a lot of these stations had news departments. So, like, you know, one of my jobs in the morning as the morning anchor was after I was done with my shift, which began at 4 a.m., and my newscast ended at 8:30, was I would start calling up the affiliates and saying, hey, do you have any news for us that, you know, you'd want to string to our network? And, of course, we'd pay you for that. And it was kind of funny in a sad way. As time went on, I'd start calling the affiliates, and I'd hear the same message, which was, we've been fired. The newsroom's being dissolved. We've been bought by Clear Channel, and they're killing off the local news, and they're going to replace it with a syndicated product. And so we're no longer going to be an affiliate of yours. Or we're going to be an affiliate of yours, but there's not going to be an actual news person here anymore. You're it. You're the only news we're going to have on our radio station. And that was depressing for me, to listen to all of these journalists, you know, mostly in smaller markets, talking about losing their jobs. And at the same time, I was also working on a website. I was part of a .com experiment. The site's called About.com now, but it basically they hired people to write and maintain a website on a certain subject. So it was kind of like the human-powered internet. Instead of going to a search engine and getting a list of algorithms and you know, responses, which may or may not be good, you can go to pirateradio.about.com, and you can get me, who's watching the scene on a weekly basis and, you know, keeps his links library up to date and fresh. And so here I was living in these two worlds for like 3 years, from 1997 to 2000. On one side, I was going to work every day, and I was being a radio journalist. I was speaking with the nice voice, the conversational cadence. I was writing the short soundbite, you know, type of radio journalism that I knew, and that was the way the system worked. And then on the other side, as a part-time, you know, freelance job, I'm writing about things like how the FCC might be trying to create new community radio stations to counteract the forces of consolidation.
So, And so that's a good point. We can kind of diverge for a second, John, because
sure.
I mean, that's exactly the point where we got to know each other, because I was studying a lot, some of these same issues that you were starting to see, you know, firsthand there in radio. And I was studying them academically, and I also been started studying them just on the side. I'd started producing a weekly radio show on WEFT down in Champaign, Urbana, down on Sunday mornings, a slightly less lively time slot than after the rock show here.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we met because of your connection with AboutBach.com, and I was reading. And so there's a guy I'd like to play some audio from who I played early on in the Radio Free Conscience days. He's from Central Illinois, from Springfield, actually, who is an unlicensed radio operator to this day, but going all the way back to 1987, probably I would say he has to be the longest running unlicensed radio operator in the United States, at least that
True
anyone
that.
Knows of. His name is Mbana Kantako. And I think what he has to say, and it's a message which is, you know, comes not from graduate school and comes not from the educated, very sort of bookish way that maybe I come at it about media freedom and the ability to communicate. He's bringing it to us originally from, you know, the public housing of Springfield, Illinois. And so he gave a talk back in 1998 at the University of Illinois in Springfield. I was lucky not to be able to attend because it's not something he does very often. Because, you know, mostly he's just, you know, a guy who runs runs his own radio station.
He's also blind.
And he's also blind, and he built it himself.
You know, I mean, this is a person who chose radio as a means to express problems in their community because he can't read.
Yeah.
He can't see, you know. Not only is it cheaper to put an unlicensed radio station on the air than it is to, you know, buy your own printing press, but when you want to serve up news in a hurry, in the most easily accessible format possible, in a culture which is, in many ways, an oral culture, the best way you go about doing that is you put up a radio station.
Yep.
And that's what Mbana Kantako did.
So we've got a little excerpt of that talk from February 1998, originally aired in March of 2004 on Media Geek. And if Andrew, if you could cue it up and play it, that'd be great.
To the ancestors, to the elders, to the adults, to the children, to the unborn, whether you're with us this afternoon or amongst those who may hear this over Human Rights Radio, Zalango. It's a greeting we use to basically try to make everybody feel comfortable. It means come let us co-create something beautiful out of love and truth. And that's really what we've been trying to do at Human Rights Radio, though we didn't know it even back in the day when it was called WTRA. And I guess that's what we're here to talk about. I work at Human Rights Radio and what we feel it's about. If you read quite a few national magazines and so forth, you'll find that they refer to us as the founder of the micro radio movement. I've got to be honest with you, never in our work did we ever discuss becoming a part of a micro radio movement. Never in our work did we discuss anything like that. From the very beginning, our efforts were toward addressing the wrongs that our people were enduring in this country. So back in the day, I guess November 87, summer of 87, we were discussing the development of what's now grown to be Human Rights Radio. It wasn't with we had no intent of saying, hey, if we do this, we'll be the first ones in the country to do. Our intention when we started up the station was simply to address the unfair situation that our people were being subjected to. And at the time, from the title of the station, you can tell we thought it was really like a landlord-tenant matter. WTRA stood for W Tenants' Rights Association. We wasn't really trying to do anything, but we thought from the way we had been propagandized that within the confines of the system, there were steps one could take to address injustices. And if one would take those steps, then those injustices would be dealt with. Well, we went that way. I mean, you know, we went. And I can remember going to, say, the criminal operation called the Springfield Housing Authority at the time, and I was asking them for a copy of their HUD manuals, you know, the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development, Rules of Life of Our People. They had these manuals that the Housing Authority had, and I remember getting them. And man, if each of them was about 4 inches thick, and I remember taking them to the house, and I remember just telling myself, all you need to do is learn what's in these books, and man, when you start running it down to them, everything gonna change. Well, we learned quite a bit what was in those books. And when we went to our first confrontation with the Housing Authority on the first thing that they informed us once they saw how aware we was of the contents of those books was that those books are outdated. We got some new ones now. That's devastating, man, when you take all that time to, you know, get up on all these different information to find out that, well, it really forced us to question what we was doing then. And about the same time our Creator blessed us, you know, so many times we can't even name them all, but around the same time we ran into a brother by the name of Sasaya Kankaji. And I got to say, by the Creator's permission, we've been blessed to have an opportunity to study with some of the best teachers around. One in this room, Brother Michael Townsend, and Brother Muhammad Salam out of Atlanta, Georgia, a Muslim. And we studied with Yahweh Ben Yahweh, the leading Hebrew in the country, for quite some time. We had an opportunity to sit at the feet of many folks that had knowledge to share with us. But at the time, we just got kicked around by the housing. We were sitting at the feet of a brother by the name of Sasaya Kankaji. And I was letting him know how disappointed I was that I had did all that studying on them books, and then they told me that the books were irrelevant. And he was saying, well, brother, you know, you ought to start thinking about rules that they can't change. Well, hell, I never knew nothing like that in my life, rules that they can't change. And he started talking to me about human rights. And at the time, I was like, wait a minute, what is human rights? And he said, these are the rights you're born with, brother. And I thought, oh, here we go again. They done finally got somebody that's going to try to take the militancy out of our work. Get us to do some of this old pray all night kind of work. You know what I'm saying? And so we didn't really want to hear about human rights. But the more we tried to make ourselves aware of different things like the rules regarding voter registration. Yeah, that was one other thing we ran into. We was registering folks to vote because, you know, we again thought in the beginning that within the confines of the system, we could address the injustices and they would be dealt with. So we registered the group we was with called the Tenants' Rights Association, WTRA stood for. We registered more folks to vote probably than any organization of its kind in the city of Springfield. And what we thought, well, we're doing our best to register folks, and once we came up with the idea, you know, they got them little voting things that they got to use when you do finally get to the polls that maybe some of our people are a little unsure about using. If we could get one of them and take to the homes when we register people, we could, like, get rid of some of the apprehensions in the people about voting. We looked in the rules of the voting thing, in the registering thing. There were no rules against it whatsoever. But when we brought it up to the election commission, you thought we'd grow the tail when we was talking to them. Man, they went off. No, we can't do it. Well, show us where it says you can't do it at then. There was nothing that said they couldn't do it. But they chose not to allow us to do it. And oh, when we started up the radio station. Well, it's kind of clear. We looked at the situation and there was no rules about no radio station under 100 watts. There was no rules whatsoever about a radio station with less than 100 watts. So who in the world would get upset when someone would start one that's 0.4 watts? Not even a half of a watt. Those that write the rules got upset about it, of course. Well, you know, when you keep on trying to go by the rules and you notice that every time you get the rules down pat and you come to the arena to do battle that they change the rules, pretty soon, if you're intelligent, sooner or later, you got to say, wait a minute now. And more I tried to deny it, the more it made sense, this human rights discussion. These rights that we be born with. The right to live, the right to grow, the right to be what one was created to be. The more those rights started to sound good to us. And we tried to follow what was happening with the political situation, and it came to our attention that every legislative session, the spring session, the criminal operation called the Illinois State Legislature, they passed 1,400 new laws. went down the Capitol building one time and ran into the Book of Laws, thicker than you is tall. And ain't none of y'all in this room can stand up and tell us that you're a law-abiding citizen for certain, because you don't know what the laws are. And if you learned the ones from last year, they got 1,400 new ones for you this year. Boy, those human rights start sounding better and better. And when the FCC showed up in 1989 to tell us that we was breaking a law that they hadn't even wrote, boy, those human rights start sounding even better.
And that is Mbana Kantako, a man from Springfield, Illinois, who operated Human Rights Radio, in fact, still operates Human Rights Radio, an unlicensed station aimed at human rights, and especially the African-American community there in the capital city of Illinois, recorded February 19th, 1998, University of Illinois, Springfield. And Mbana was visited and busted by the FCC again on November 30th of 2000, and then returned to the air due to great donations from people around the world on March 2001. I think right there in that short little bit, Mbana Kantako put in perspective, you know, the notion of being able to communicate and the need to be able to communicate and organize with information in a mass way, using the means at hand. And then the interesting thing there is that, indeed, and in the time period that Mbana Kantako was talking about in the 1980s, while there certainly has always been a prohibition against people broadcasting without a license, there's no way you could have gotten a license for a station under 100 watts in 1987.
No.
You could apply for it,
and
but you'd never have gotten it.
I think it's also important to point out the fact that Mbana Kantako talks about how his focus for what the radio station was going to be changed over time. I mean, initially the radio station was set up as a way to address issues that were specifically affecting Springfield's African American community. There was the Tenants' Rights Association he's talking about was basically the city wanted to demolish one of the housing projects where Mbana Kantako and a lot of his family and friends lived. And so he started the radio station as an advocacy way for tenants to speak to the local issue of whether or not they're going to lose their homes. Springfield in the 80s also went through a terrible period of police brutality where people were actually killed. That was the time during which Mbana lost his sight due to a police raid at which he was DJing and got clubbed in the head. And so he used the radio station as a way to bear witness to what was happening oppressively to Springfield, the African-American community. He organized and encouraged people to take tape recorders out in the streets and tape their daily experiences with the police and then bring it to him to play. And so the station started from a very local need to organize and speak to one another on issues that were, you know, almost life and death, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And as he began to see the power of that radio station in operation in his local community, the housing project was eventually torn down, but police brutality was brought under control. He began to then see a larger picture. And that's when he starts talking about human rights. And he's referring to a law. For as much as he, you know, says he does not believe in man's law because man's law was written in times when, you know, we were back on slave ships 500 years ago, one of the main tenets that provides Mbana with the moral authority to do what he's doing is something called Article 19 of the International Declaration of Human Rights. It's a UN-chartered constitutional bill of rights. And it effectively says that everyone should have the right to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't just mean the right to stand up on a street corner and say your piece in public. It also means right to the means by which we communicate, rights to the airwaves, rights to newspapers and things like that, rights to access to media. And that's the big jump where Mbana, whether he liked it or not, became a symbolic, an icon, you know, for other people who were feeling the same way about the state of our media environment. There were problems going on in their own community, or they knew something was wrong with the state of the media, but they didn't quite know what they could do about it. And here came along this guy who came from nowhere out of nothing and inspired people. You know, he was an inspiration. And from that, we saw the growth of these small, low-power stations over the course of the 1990s.
All unlicenced. Unlicensed low-power.
Unlicensed stations, as it was called, the micro-radio movement, as he referred to it. And that forced the FCC to take action, which led to the creation of a new low-power FM service in 2000. And that's when I quit the commercial radio industry. I finally realized that there was two paths I could follow if I wanted to stay engaged in the medium in which I love. I could stay in the vapid, soundbite, non-informational world of commercial radio, where the higher up in market size you get, the less you're a journalist and the more you're a personality. Or I could take the harder path, the one that doesn't, you know, lead to a career, and I could align myself with people who I thought were using radio for the best moral purposes. And that's community radio, that's pirate radio, that's low-power FM broadcasting. And that's why I'm in graduate school now, you know, is because I want to learn more about what happened to the career that I chose and why it evaporated out from underneath my feet. And I want to prevent it from getting worse. And I want to try to re-engage a sense of democratic communication in what is, supposedly a democracy.
And this isn't just happening in the early 2000s. It's still happening today. And I'd actually like Andrew, totally. Andrew Gottelf, who's been engineering here and producing for me, and I really appreciate it, who is a journalism student himself. And Andrew, you had an internship this summer at a radio station, correct?
Right. I interned at AM 560 WIND, which is a conservative talk radio station, but they do have news every half hour, and I interned at the news department with the afternoon anchor.
And can you tell us what that was like? What was it like there? Doing hard cutting edge journalism, really digging deep into stories and raking the muck. How was that?
Well, not so much. Actually, what happened with the news anchor, I mean, she would go on every half hour, every 15 minutes to do traffic and weather. Basically, her extent of reporting the news was checking the AP and Metro Wires and CNN and whatnot, and rewriting stories, you know, trying to spin it with a Chicago spin on it, but she didn't have enough time. What's that?
Rip and read.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And she didn't have enough time to make a personal phone call or go to the bathroom, let alone make a phone call to report on the news or do any sort of investigation. It was sort of almost depressing as a student of journalism to see that that's what she's doing with her journalism degree. That's how she's reporting the news. And then as soon as I left, she works for Metro, which is a large news organization. They made cuts, and she's gone now. She doesn't work at the station anymore. And so the way that they report their news on that station now is it comes from downtown. It goes out to a bunch of other stations, and they get prepackaged news just like a lot of other stations in the area do now.
Yeah, I have a friend, actually, who I used to work with in Valparaiso back when I was a morning news anchor there, named Bill Cerones. And if you tune around the Chicago dial, you'll hear this guy on WBBM and WGN and things like that, basically doing what you're talking about. He goes and he sits in a cubicle somewhere downtown, and he's got a little clock in front of him, and he says that, you know, 5 after you're going to read this on this radio station, and at 8 after you're going to do the traffic on WBBM. And he just sits there and spits out information. Doesn't even really think about it. Just reads it on time, hits the deadlines. And that is the state of radio journalism today, especially in major markets. It's definitely not a growth industry.
Well, because in small markets, there just isn't radio journalism
there
any
isn't.
Longer.
Yeah, it's gone. And in the major markets, you have seen over the course of several years this centralization and consolidation where news services are set up, like Metro or Shadow or things like that, that can provide an all-in-one package so that radio stations don't have to pay for their own employees.
And we're just about out of time here, John, so I really want to thank you for joining me here in the first show
sure.
here, WNUR. This is Media Geek, and John's website is at DIYmedia.net. And my name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'll be back here next week. Go to MediaGeek.net for the Media Geek website, and of course the radio program is at Radio.MediaGeek.net. You can subscribe to the podcast, you can download it, or you can listen right there in your browser, Radio paul@mediageek.net. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. I'd love to hear from you. Big thanks to Andrew Gotthelf there, who's at the controls, producing, keeping it going, and rolling with it and coming on air. I appreciate it. It's our first show out together, and I think it was a blast.